This is Audible.
Drachenfels by Kim Newman. Read by Antonia Beamish. Chapter 1. The first Genevieve Dieudonné knew of the treachery of Yuli the dwarf was the prod of a blade end in her right side, just above the hip. Cloth and skin dimpled, and she felt a wasp-like sting. There was something about the knife. It slipped under the flaps of her padded leather jerkin and into her flesh. Silver. The knife was edged with silver. Her body took fire at the touch of the charmed metal. She felt the weapon withdraw and half turned, ready for the killing thrust, for the heart strike. She heard herself hissing and knew that her face, the face she had not seen for 6 centuries, was twisted, eyes reddening, sharp corner teeth bared. The wet hole in her side closed, tingling. Blood trickled down the inside of her breeches. Somewhere on one of the nearby crags, an unclean bird was squawking as it devoured the weakest of its young. Rudy Wegner was on his knees, trying to wrestle Sia Yehan down, a hand pressed to the spewing hole in the scholar's throat. This pass they had come to, this stony and unfruitful spot high in the grey mountains, was a filthy place. It was late afternoon, and she was still slowed by the sun. Otherwise, Yuli would never have dared strike at her. She brought her ungauntleted hand up, palm out, and placed it beneath her breast, shielding her heart. The knife leaped forward, and she saw Yuli's face contorted in a feral snarl. His thumb-sized teeth were bloodied from Sia Yehan's neck, and she could see torn fragments of skin caught between them. She pushed outwards and caught the knife point with the centre of her hand. The pain was sharper this time, as the bones were displaced. She saw the point pricking outwards from the back of her hand. Flesh parted, and the red metal emerged from between her middle knuckles. Even through her slow-flowing blood, the silver caught the last of the sunlight. Yuli swore and spat red foam. He put his shoulders into the attack and tried to push her arm back, to staple her hand to her chest. If the silver so much as scraped her heart, there would be no more centuries for poor Genevieve. She could ignore the pain of the sundering of her flesh. By tomorrow, there wouldn't even be the slightest scar, but the silver burned inside her. She shoved the dwarf back, the blade sliding through her hand by agonizing inches. She felt the hilt against her palm and made a fist, gripping the dwarf's weapon with still strong fingers. With his free hand, he punched her in the kidneys, twice. She was ready for that. The blows didn't bother her. She kicked him, square in the chest, and he backed away from her, leaving his knife in her blood-slick grasp. He reached for the curved dagger in his boot, and she backhanded him. The blade that struck out like a spiked extra finger from her fist carved a deep rut across his forehead. Her hand hurt as the knife jarred against Yuli's skull. The dwarf fell back, blood in his eyes, and 3 darts appeared in a diagonal line across his chest, sunk to the feathers in his ribs. Anton Veit had used his trifurcate crossbow well. Genevieve pulled the knife out of her hand and threw it away. She made and unmade her fist as the stinging wound closed. Yuli still staggered as Veit's venom shocked his body, the little smears of death coursing through his veins, reaching for his brain. The bounty hunter mixed his poisons with unrivalled skill. Stiffening, the dwarf fell. Erzbet, the dancer assassin, looped her wire noose around Yuli's neck. She pulled it tight, cinching until she was satisfied of his death. Genevieve held out her bloodied hand. Oswald von Königswald was there with a kerchief, which she took from him. She licked the slit clean, savouring the tang of her own blood. Then she wrapped the kerchief tightly about her hand, pressing shut the already healing wound.
"Dwarf bastard," said Veit, hawking phlegm at Yuli's dead face. "You never know when one's going to turn."
"Less of the dwarfish bastardy bounty hunter," said Menesh, who had joined them with Yuli.
Genevieve had always supposed they were related.
"Look."
The traitor was growing in death. At least, his skeleton and insides were expanding. His dwarf shell and clothes split and showed raw pink and purple through great tears. Human-sized bones twisted on the ground, their wet contents pouring through the remaining ragged strips of Yuli's skin. Oswald stepped back, leery of getting his fine Tylean leather boots in the mess. Yuli's still glaring eyes popped and maggots writhed in their sockets, spilling over stretched tight cheeks and into his beard.
His tongue slithered out of his mouth like a strangling snake, twisted down impossibly long towards his chest, and then died.
Esbit voiced her disgust loudly as she pulled her noose free.
"He was no true dwarf," said Menesh.
"That's certain,"
said Rudy Wegner, who had given up staunching Sia Yehan's wounds, leaving the doctoring to his tame warlock.
"But what was he?"
Menesh shrugged, his harnessed weapons rattling, and touched the still-spreading body with his boot toe.
"A demon, perhaps? Some creature of Drakenfels?"
The dwarf kicked Yuli's swollen helmet off the wide ledge. It fell, striking the ground long after they had forgotten it. The stink of the grave wafted away from the remains of the dwarf-seeming thing who had ridden with them for 3 months. Yuli had shared quarters with them and broken bread with them. He had never spared himself in their fights, and Genevieve knew that without his deftly thrown knives, she would have been orc meat several times over. Had Yuli always been a traitor to them? Always in the service of Drakenfels? Or did his treachery begin a few moments ago, when the shadow of the fortress fell upon him? How little she really knew about any of her companions in this adventure. An adventure. That is what it had seemed when Oswald van Koenigswald, eyes ablaze, had recruited her in the Crescent Moon. She had been working in the tavern at Altdorf, trading one drink for another, for 100 years or so. Longevity brings a heavy burden of tedium. Genevieve, suspended eternally between life and death since the dark kiss, had been willing to do almost anything to relieve her boredom. Just as Anton Veit was willing to do almost anything for gold crowns, or Sia Yehan for a chance to increase his learning, Rudy Wegner to expand his glory, or Weeksted Heinroth to achieve his cherished revenge. And Oswald. What was Oswald, Crown Prince Oswald, Genevieve reminded herself, willing to do almost anything for? An adventure, a quest, the stuff of ballads and chapbooks, of legends and tavern tales. Now, with so many dead behind them and 2 more dying in her eyesight, Genevieve was less certain. Now, their business here seemed just a nasty, messy job of murder. A nasty, messy life had to be ended. But murder, it still was.
"Sia Yehan?" Oswald asked.
Rudy, the ruddy cheeriness gone from his bluff bandit's face, shook his head. The scholar was still bleeding, but his eyes showed only white. He had stopped kicking. Stellan the warlock looked up from the corpse.
"He had no chance. The dwarf bit clean through his throat to the bone. He'd have bled to death if he hadn't been strangling for lack of air, or the other way round. Either would have done for him."
"Enough," said Oswald. "We must go on. It's nearly nightfall. Things will be more difficult after dark."
Difficult for the others, better for her. The sun dipped below the horizon, and Genevieve felt her night senses come back. She could ignore the echoes of pain in her hand and sighed. Above them all, the fortress of Drachenfels stood against the crimson sky, its seven turrets thrust skywards like the taloned fingers of a deformed hand. The clifftop gates were, as ever, open, a maw in the side of the stone. Genevieve saw the eyes in the darkness beyond the gates, half-imagined, unwelcoming shapes flitting past innumerable windows, themselves shaped like eyes. This was where their adventure would end, in a castle as grey and jagged as the mountains around it, a fortress older than the Empire and darker than death, the lair of the great enchanter, Drachenfels.
Chapter 2. Constant Drachenfels, the great enchanter, had been old, had been ancient, long before the first birth of Genevieve Sandrine du Pointe du Lac Dieudonné, and that, she never allowed herself to forget, had been 638 years ago. In true life, Genevieve's home had been the city of Paravon, in the east of Britannia, where her father was minister to the first family, and her sisters were counted among the greatest beauties of a court renowned throughout the known world for its great beauties. Drachenfels had been more often abroad among men in those days, and wont to show his metal-masked face in the courts and palaces of Britannia and the Empire. The stories were fresher then. Tales were told in a whisper of his vast debauches, of his inconceivable crimes, of his devastating rages, of his titanic sorceries, of his terrible revenges, and of his single defeat. Drachenfels had been one of the powers of the world. She supposed, though half forgotten, he still was. He had only been bested once, at the hands of Sigmar Heldenhammer. Strange to think that Sigmar had been deemed a man then. A hero, but still a man. Now the priests called him the patron deity of the Empire. Sigmar was gone, no one knew where, but the monster he had once humbled was still here. The evil of Drachenfels was still very much with the world. As a girl of 12, 4 years before the dark kiss, Genevieve had seen Drachenfels in person. He rode through Paravon with his army of the dead, bedecked in gorgeous silks, wearing his mask of gold. The heads of the first family's militia captains bobbed open-mouthed on pikes. An assassin dashed from the crowds and was torn to pieces by Drachenfels' rotting lieutenants. Demons danced in the air, bearing away pieces of the martyred Daggerman. Genevieve hid behind her sister's skirts, but got a good look all the same. Her father's friends had discussed Drachenfels in her presence. His origins were unknown, his weaknesses unknown, his powers unlimited, his evil depthless. Even his face had not been seen by living man. She had tried to conceive of a hideousness under the mask, a hideousness so dreadful that it would make the skull and meat faces of Drachenfels' armies seem attractive. Or, as her sister Cyrielle suggested, a handsomeness so awesome that all who gazed upon it were struck dead in an instant. Cyrielle was always the silly one. She had died of the plague some 50 years, a heart's beat really, later. Drachenfels had his tribute from Paravon, but slew the first family nevertheless, as an example. Genevieve's father also perished, served with other public officials as a meal for one of the enchanter's attendant demons. 600 years later, Genevieve could summon little thirst for vengeance. Her father would have lived another 20, 30 years, 35 at the most, and would still be lost to her memory.
It's hard to think the premature death of a mayfly any great tragedy. She sometimes found the faces of her parents, her sisters, her friends at court, popping into her mind. But mostly, those were lost times, a life that had happened to someone else. A few years later, years that were now minutes to her memory, Chandaignac came to her uncle's house. Chandaignac, with his dark eyes and plaited beard, his needle-like teeth and tales of the world's youth. She received the dark kiss and was born a second time, born into this half-life. Chandaignac was dead too. He had always been too flamboyant for their kind and made too many important enemies. Finally, the priests of Ulric hunted him down and pinned him to the ground with a length of hawthorn while they sawed off his head with a silver scimitar. That was 300 years ago. She was the last of his get that she knew of. There were many others older than she, but they lived far to the east on the borders of Kislev and kept to themselves. Occasionally, mindless dead things would come to the crescent moon, drawn by her presence, and she would turn them out or put an end to them, depending on how she felt. Sometimes they could be a nuisance. Centuries had passed, and everything had changed many times. Empires, dynasties, wars, alliances, cities, a few great men, numberless little ones, monsters, arts and sciences, forests, all had come and gone like the seasons of the year. Genevieve was still walking the earth, and so was Drachenfels. She wondered if he felt the same suppressed kinship for her that she felt for him. There were songs that they, alone of all the world, would recognise, once famous names that they alone knew, extinct animals the taste of whose meat they alone could recall. Probably he did not feel for her. Probably he was only dimly aware of her. She was what she was, at best the cousin of humanity. But Drachenfels was beyond even that. He had ceased to be any kind of a man long before he rode into Paravon. The face he kept beneath his bland collection of metalwork masks would not remotely resemble anything else that drew breath. Tonight, one way or another, she would look upon that face. Perhaps long dead and dust Ciriel was right after all. Perhaps she would not survive the sight. And perhaps, after 6.5 centuries, she would not mind dying all that much. She had followed Drachenfels's career down through the ages, kept a mental note of the kingdoms sacked and bled dry, the plagues unleashed, the tributes exacted, the demons set free. He had been quiet for a few centuries now, quiet in his impregnable fortress in the grey mountains. Some believed Drachenfels dead, but there were too many evidences of his continued handiwork throughout the old world. The wizards who frequented the crescent moon would talk about him sometimes, about the disturbances he was making in that sphere beyond time and space where the greatest of enchanters venture in search of the vast principal beings of the universe. They knew enough not to sign up with Oswald's expedition. Some said he was too old to be the monster he once was, but Genevieve knew that immortals grow rather than diminish in strength as they put years behind them. Some ventured that the great enchanter was voyaging within himself, trying to plumb the depths of his own darkness, to summon the worst of his personal demons. One song, sung only by a strange-visaged Bretonian minstrel, suggested Drachenfels was meditating his many sins, finding the strength to battle again with Sigmar, and that this time he would vanquish the wielder of the Warhammer forever, bringing about the end of all things. She had heard all manner of rumours, but none had touched her more than any other tavern gossip, until Prince Oswald von Königswald
son of the Elector of Oestland, walked into the crescent moon. He told her that Constant Drachenfels was preparing to return to the world and take over the empire, and that the great enchanter would have to be stopped before he could bring down fiery doom upon an entire continent. That had been 3 months ago. Oswald was a year or two older than she had been when Chandaniac had kissed her. She supposed him a handsome youth, and could see around him the aura of the great and noble man he would grow into. He would be Elector after his father, of course. The Elector of Oestland could sometimes sway the others completely and hold the course of the empire in his hands. Never had a candidate opposed by Oestland succeeded. Never. Oswald's father lived in a comparatively modest palace, but upon occasion, Luitpold himself came to his court as if the Elector were emperor and he the supplicant. If Luitpold's son, Karl Franz, were to succeed him on the throne, he would need the support of Oswald's father. Indeed, since the Elector had married late and was now nearing the end of his middle years, the emperor would soon need the support of Prince Oswald. Genevieve had heard that the prince was a serious youth, a young man capable of outstripping all his tutors in everything from gastronomy to philosophy, and who was as skilled with the Istalian guitar as with the longbow of Albion. The tavern jesters told jokes about the grave-faced boy who had, it was rumoured, once shamed Luitpold into withdrawing a proposed edict against harlotry by asking if the emperor intended to set an example by burning at the stake a certain substantial Tylian fortune-teller, much in evidence at court functions since the demise of the Lady Empress. And Genevieve had read, with interest, a slender but acclaimed volume of verse in the classical style, published anonymously, but later revealed through a careless boast on the part of the Elector's tutor-in-residence, Seer Jehan, to be the work of Oswald von Königswald. Nevertheless, she had been unprepared for his ice-clear eyes, the strength of his handshake, and the directness of his speech. In the back room of her tavern, Oswald had offered her his wrist. She had declined. Aristocratic blood was too rich for her. She depended upon the friendless, the unmourned. In Altdorf, there were many without whom the empire, indeed the world, would be much improved. And they had been her meat and drink since she had decided to settle down. Seer Jehan was with the prince, a bag full of scrolls and bound books with him, and Anton Veit, the bounty hunter, who cared for his weapons as others care for their women. Oswald knew about her father. Oswald knew things about her that she had herself forgotten. He offered her a chance for revenge, and, when that hadn't been a temptation, appealed to her need for variety, for change. The young Sigmar must have been like this, she thought, as she sensed the excitement Oswald was suppressing. All heroes must have been like this. Suddenly, rashly, she longed for a taste of him, a flavour of the pepper in his blood. She didn't mention her rush of lust, but somehow she knew that he had seen the desire in her, and answered her longing with a need of his own, a need that would have to be postponed until after the accomplishment of his current mission. She looked into his eyes, into the eyes in which her face was not reflected, and, for the first time in centuries, felt alive again. Seer Jehan laid out the proofs of Drachenfels's recent doings. He read aloud the testament, obtained through a medium, of a wizard who had lately been found flayed and boneless in his chambers. The dead sorcerer alleged that all manner of magical and demoniacal forces were converging on the fortress of Drachenfels, and that the great enchanter was reaching new levels of power. Then the scholar talked of a plague of dreams and visions that had been reported by the priests of all the gods.
A masked man was seen, striding over a blasted land, between the fires that had been cities and the deserts that had been forests. The dead were piled high as mountains, and the rivers were 9 parts blood to 1 part water. The forces of evil were gathering, and Drachenfels was at their heart. Oswald intended to face the monster in his lair and vanquish him forever. Again he offered her the chance to join the party, and this time she relented. Only then did he reveal that his father, and presumably Emperor Luitpold himself, had refused to believe Sia Yehan's evidence, and that he was pursuing this venture unsupported by any imperial forces. They set out from Altdorf for the Grey Mountains the next day. Later, others joined. Rudi Wegner, the bandit king of the Reichwald Forest, threw in his lot with them and helped fight off the possessed remnants of his own comrades during one long, dark night in the thick of the woods. Along with Rudi came Stellan the warlock, who had lived with the bandits and was determined to pit his magics against those of the great enchanter, and Erzbet, the dancer-assassin from the world's edge, who recited every night, like a prayer, the names of those she had killed. Yuli and Manesh had been recruited at Axbite Pass, where an entire community of peaceful peasants had turned out to be demons in disguise, and where young Conradin, Oswald's squire, was spitted and eaten by an altered ogre. The dwarves had been travelling south, but were willing to pledge their swords for gold and glory. Heinroth, whose soul was eaten away by the murder of his children, joined them soon after. A raiding party of orcs from the fortress had made sport with his two little sons and killed them afterwards. He had vowed to scar himself with his serrated blade every day he let Drachenfels live, and grimly sliced at himself every morning. One day they woke up to find Heinroth turned inside out, with words carved into his bones. "Go back now." None of them had heard a thing, and the sharp-witted Veit had been standing guard. Through it all, Oswald had been at their head, undaunted by each new horror, keeping his followers together, which in the case of Veit and the dwarfs, or the licentious Erzbet and the fanatically ascetic Heinroth, hadn't been easy, and forever confident of the eventual outcome. Sia Yehan told her that he had been like this since childhood. The scholar evidently loved the boy as a son, and chose to follow Oswald when the prince's real father had refused to listen. These were the last great days, Genevieve had thought, and their names would live in ballads forever. Now, Conradin was dead. Sia Yehan was dead. Heinroth was dead. Yuli was dead. And before the night was over, others, maybe all of the party, would be joining them. She hadn't thought about dying for a long time. Perhaps tonight, Drachenfels would finish Chandaniac's dark kiss and push her at last over the border between life and death. Oswald walked straight up to the open gates of the fortress, looked casually about, and signalled to them. He stepped into the dark. Genevieve followed him, and the others came after her. Chapter 3. As they ventured further, Stellan the warlock began chanting in a language Genevieve didn't recognise. He glowed slightly, and she fancied she saw his attendant spirits dancing around him. Sometimes she could see things the others couldn't. Stellan's voice grew louder as they advanced down the stone corridor, and his gestures more extravagant. Firefly entities spiralled around him, clustering to his amulets, stirring his long, womanish hair. Evidently, he was invoking great powers. He had done so before other battles, and claimed credit for their victories. At the end of the passage was an aged wooden door, with inset copper designs. It was too easy to see a face in the abstract curlicues. Genevieve knew the effect was deliberate. Nothing in this place happened unless it was by design. Drachenfels' design. The face she saw was that of the impassive mask the great enchanter had worn in Paravon. Maybe there were other faces for the others, a cruel parent, an implacable foe, an unbanished demon. Erzbit was badly affected. Genevieve could hear the dancer assassin's blood quickening. Even Veit and Rudy were tense. Only Oswald kept his chilly calm, his princely composure. Oswald went ahead, a torch held high in one hand, sword out like a blind man's cane. Stellan followed close behind, feeling the way with his magics. Genevieve heard rhythms and repetitions in his chanting now, and noticed Rudy praying in unison with the warlock, his thick lips mouthing silently Stellan's words. The warlock's spirits were around him like a protective garment. They all must be praying to their gods now, all who had gods. In this heart of Drachenfels, Genevieve's night senses told her things she wished not to know. It was as if a million insects crawled upon her skin, biting with silvered mandibles, shrieking in a cacophony. There was great danger nearby, great evil. But you didn't have to have the heightened perception of vampire kind to know that. Even poor half-witted Erzbert could tell they were walking into a great and dreadful darkness. Their guttering torches were pitiful against the blackness of the interior of the fortress. "The door," said Stellan in Reichspiel. "It's guarded by spells." Oswald paused and extended his sword. He touched the metal and sparks flew. The inlay grew white hot and foul smoke curled out as the wood burned. The imagined face looked angered now and glared hatred at them. "Can you open it, warlock?" asked the prince. Stellan smiled his confident, one-sided smile. "Of course, Highness. A mere conjurer could penetrate these petty charms. I'm surprised that an enchanter of Drachenfels' standing would stoop to such things." The warlock reached into a pouch and with a flourish threw a handful of sweet-smelling dust at the door. The face went dark again and Stellan reached for the doorknob. He twisted it and pushed the door open, standing aside to let the prince through before him. With a mocking grin, he bowed. "See," he said, "it was simple." Then Stellan the warlock simply exploded. They were drenched in gore, the door hung with ribbons of cloth and meat, the stone walls dripped red for 10 feet behind them. Stellan's naked skeleton stood for a moment, still grinning, then collapsed. Rudy, Manesh and Veit swore loudly and frantically scraped at themselves, dislodging the chunks of flesh and scraps of clothing that had plastered them. Oswald calmly wiped off his face. Genevieve felt her red thirst rising, but fought it back. This was no banquet for her. She would rather drink pig swill than feed like this. Stellan's spirits were gone, snuffed out with their summoner.
"The walls," said Veit. "They're changing."
Genevieve looked up at the ceiling. The stones were molten, reshaping themselves. There were faces in the walls and jutting rock claws reaching out for them. Oswald swung his sword with practiced grace and a dead hand fell to the floor, shattering as it landed. Rudy drew the two-handed sword slung on his back and began to hack away at the emerging creatures.
"Careful, fool outlaw," shouted Veit, barely avoiding Rudy's blade. "That's not a corridor weapon."
A stone head rolled at Genevieve's feet. Its glass eyes milked over, swollen tongue poked out. One of the creatures, a squat gargoyle, had detached itself completely from the ceiling and dropped down on her. It grabbed for her hair. She made a fist and struck it in the chest. It was like punching a mountain. Any human hand would have been pulverized. Pain ran up through her arm to her shoulder,
and she knew her wound was reopening. The gargoyle was shocked to a halt, a hairline crack across its torso, running from horny shoulder to waist. It lunged for her, stone hands creaking as it made razor-sharp talons. It was too near for her to draw her sword against it, so she was pushed back. The wall behind her writhed with life, sprouting claws of its own. She braced herself against the shifting stones, turning to face the wall, and kicked out with a booted foot, aiming high, aiming for the crack. The gargoyle staggered back, split. The top half of its body slid from the bottom and crashed to the floor. It was a pile of dead stones. They fought their way through the creatures, smashing them when they could, and found themselves forced through the open door into an abandoned chamber where a great table was set for dinner. The food had long since crumbled to dust. So had the diners, whose dry skeletons were slumped in their chairs in the remains of their finery. Here, there was room to fight properly, and Rudy's sword counted. Gargoyles fell. The bandit chief held the doorway, swinging his blade about him, and the creatures flew to fragments. Finally, with a grunt, he kicked the door shut on the last of the enemy. Vite and Oswald piled in with heavy chairs that could be stacked against the wood. Efficiently, they barricaded themselves into the dining hall of the dead. Genevieve gripped her aching hand and tried to set the bones in their proper places. She managed to push her fingers back in joint. Her wound was bleeding slightly as she smoothed it over. She hoped no silver traces were caught inside. That could cause gangrene, and she would have to have the hand or the limb amputated. It might be 100 years before she grew a new one. It had taken Chandagnac an entire generation to regain an ear lopped off by an overzealous priest of the old faith. She looked down at herself. Her breeches, boots and jerkin were filthy and stinking, as if she had crawled through the mud of a plague pit. The others were in no better condition, although Oswald bore his dirt and rags as if they were perfumed silks. And Vite had never looked any different. The only clean things about him were his weapons.
"What happened here?" Rudy asked.
"A poison feast," said Oswald. "It's one of the worst Drachenfels stories. He appeared alone on his knees at the court of the Emperor nearly 6 centuries ago and offered to make penance for his sins. He paid generous reparations to all his living victims and abased himself at the graves of many others. He renounced evil and swore allegiance to the gods he had previously cursed. He vowed his loyalty to the Empire. Everyone was convinced he had changed. In 10,000 years, anyone might repent, might wish to cleanse his heart. Any man, that is. He invited the Emperor Carolus and all his court to this place to celebrate his new life, and decreed that Drachenfels would forever be open as a shelter for the destitute. Some of Carolus's advisers spoke against the feast, but the Emperor was a kindly man, and too young to remember Drachenfels' worst deeds. They came here, all of them, the Emperor and the Empress Irina, their children, and all the nobles of the court. My own ancestor, Schlichter von Königswald, sat here, among them." They looked at the abandoned corpses and saw the jewels lying under cobwebs. One smiling dowager corpse had rubies in her eye sockets and a silver-set net of pearls, sapphires and diamonds on her bare ribs. Genevieve picked a tarnished gold circlet from a broken skull.
"The old crown," Rudy said, eyes alight with avarice. "It's priceless."
"We'll return it, my outlaw friend," Oswald said. "There'll be plunder for you, but this crown we will return." Oswald had promised Rudy Wegner a pardon when they returned to Altdorf in triumph, but knew, as Genevieve knew, the bandit would not accept it. Once this good deed, this honourable revenge was done, he would be returning to the forests, to the outlaw life. Genevieve looked at the corpses and saw flashes of a long-ago day.
The chamber was clean and new and brightly lit. She heard laughter and music. She saw dishes being served. Handsome gentlemen were charming. Beautiful ladies fluttered fans. And at the head of the table, a regal man with a crown was attended by a plainly dressed man in a simple tin mask. She blinked, and the dark present was back.
"He poisoned them, then?" Manesh asked Oswald.
"Yes, only they didn't die. They were paralysed, turned to feeling statues. Years later, one of Drakenfell's minions made a confession before he went to the gallows. He told the whole story of the obscenities that took place before the helpless eyes of Carolus and his court. They had brought their children, you see, those foolish and trusting nobles. Heinroth would have understood the horror. After the entertainments were over, Drakenfels left his guests frozen, with a feast laid out before them. They starved to death." Oswald struck the table with his sword hilt. It shook. Brittle crockery broke. A candelabrum fell over. A rat burst from its nest in a ribcage. A skeleton, still bedecked in the robes of the High Priestess of Verena, fell apart. Tears stood out on the prince's face. Genevieve had never seen him betray such emotion. "Fools!" Genevieve laid a hand on his shoulder, and he calmed instantly. "After this night, Drakenfels will prey on no more fools." He strode across the chamber and pulled open a set of double doors. "Come on." The minion also drew maps. He bought himself a quick death. "Drakenfels's chambers lies beyond these passageways. We're near him." Chapter 4. The fortress was the man, Genevieve thought. The towers and battlements, the corridors and chambers, the very mountain crag which the bowels of Drakenfels were carved from. They were the great enchanter's arteries and organs, his blood and bones. Oswald's band might as well be penetrating Drakenfels' body like knives striking for his heart. Or they might be fragments of food tumbling down his gullet. And wasn't that a comforting thought? Erzbit alone was doubtful as they followed Oswald. She was talking to herself, reciting the names of her dead. The corridors were wider here and hung with tapestries. One depicted the great enchanter at play, and a deal of red thread had to be employed. Even Veit paled at what was shown here. Oswald glanced at the central panels of the hanging and slashed out with his sword. The entire dusty tapestry fell and lay on the floor like a fenworm's cast-off skin. Manesh touched his torch to it, and in an instant the fire spread along its length. The next tapestry, a group portrait of the certain dreaded gods, caught too. "Very clever, stunted lackwit," spat Veit. "Burning us up now, is it? That makes a change from the traditional dwarfish knife in the small of the back." The dwarf pulled his knife and held it up. Veit had his dart pistol out. There were fires all around them. "A traitor, eh? Like dead and damned Yuli?"
"I'll give you dead and damned, scavenger."
Manesh stabbed up, but Veit stepped out of the way, flames reflected in the bounty hunter's dark eyes. He took careful aim. "Enough," Oswald cried. "We've not come this far to fall out now."
"Veit cries traitor too much," Rudy said sourly. "I trust no one who can be bought as easily."
The outlaw heaved his sword up, and Veit turned again.
"Ethics from a bandit, that's rich. Better a bandit than a trader of corpses. Your corpse is hardly worth the 75 crowns the Empire has offered for it."
The pistol came up. The sword wavered in the air.
"Kill him and be done with it," said Manesh.
This was like Veit, and like the hot-tempered Rudy. But Manesh had been quiet until now, dodging Veit's taunts with good humour. Something was working on them, something unnatural. Genevieve staggered forward as someone landed on her back, pushing her face to the floor.
Ha! Dead bitch!
Erzbeth's noose was about her neck and drawing in. She had taken her by surprise. Genevieve had to struggle to brace her hands against the flagstones, to give herself the leverage to heave Erzbeth off her. The wire constricted. The assassin knew her business. Beheading would work all right. Immortality is so fragile. Beheading, the hawthorn, silver, too much sun. Genevieve got her hand under her, palm flat against the stone, and pushed herself up. Erzbeth tried to ride her like an unbroken pony, her knees digging into the ribs. Genevieve corded her neck muscles and forced breath down her windpipe. She heard the wire snap and felt Erzbeth tumble from her seat. She stood and struck out. The other woman took the blow heavily and fell. Erzbeth rolled on the floor and came up, a knife in her hand. Did it gleam silver like Yuli's?
The dead can die, leech woman.
Genevieve felt the urge to kill. Kill the stinking living slut. Kill all these warm-blood bastard vermin. Kill, kill, kill!
Fight it, shouted Oswald. It's an attack, an enchantment.
She turned to the prince.
Horse unnoble, sister-raping, wealth-besotted scum, drenched in perfume to cover the stench of his own ordure.
Oswald held her, shaking her by the shoulders.
Blood, royal blood, rich, spiced, hot on the tongue, youthfully gushing blood.
The vein throbbed in his throat. She took his wrists in her strong hands, feeling their pulses. She heard his heart beating like a steady drum, and saw him as a student of anatomy might a dissected corpse. Veins and arteries laid through flesh and over bone. The blood called to her. How long since she had fed properly? Oswald broke her grip and slapped her. She found herself and saw only his clear eyes in the dark. He kissed her on the cheek and stood back. The thirst could wait. Oswald went to each of them in turn, calmed them. Erzbeth was the last. She had pressed herself into a corner of the passageway and refused to come out unless coaxed. She waved her knife. Oswald took her hand and pulled the knife out of it. The woman was mad, Genevieve realised, and had been for hours. Erzbeth emerged from her bolt hole when Oswald talked to her in a low, soothing voice. She clung to the prince like a frightened child to its mother during the Demon King's scenes of a puppet play. Oswald detached the dancer assassin from his shoulder and passed her to Rudy. The chastened, suddenly serious bandit took her on his arm. Had they been lovers? Genevieve wondered. And Erzbeth pressed herself to his side. She sensed Veit about to make a remark about their new burden. But he kept quiet. Good for him. The fires were dying. They walked again. Erzbeth was useless now, and Veit, weather-beaten and hardy Veit, was ailing. He had sustained a wound during the battle with the gargoyles. It was just a scratch on his face, a newer scar among so many old ones, but it was still bleeding steadily, and he had a greyish look. He was moving slowly now, lagging behind them. His sharpness was going, and he blundered too often against the walls. Genevieve heard a clattering and looked back. Veit had dropped his trifurcate crossbow, his dart pistol, and his sword belt. He was trudging on, trailing them like a prisoner his ball and chain. This was unthinkable. Veit would never drag his beloved weapons through the dirt. Manesh, who had taken so many insults from the bounty hunter, went to him and offered a shoulder to be leaned on. Veit put out a hand to steady himself, but missed Manesh and fell clumsily against the wall. He crawled on and finally came to rest, gasping for breath, at Oswald's feet. Manesh pulled him upright and propped him against the wall. His face was ashen and he was drooling. He went into convulsions. The dwarf held him down.
He can't go on, Highness.
Oswald picked up Veit's dart pistol.
It was a fine piece of workmanship, a coil spring-powered gun that could drive a 6-inch nail through an oak door. The prince checked it for dirt and blew a cobwebby lump off the barrel. He thrust the weapon into Veit's hand and he gripped it. The bounty hunter had come through the convulsions.
"We leave him," said Oswald. "We'll pass this way again."
Veit nodded and weakly raised his hand in salute. He wasn't holding the pistol correctly, Genevieve realised. His fingers weren't on the trigger. If he wasn't helped, he'd be dead by dawn. But they could all be dead by dawn.
Manesh took a stone from his pocket and handed it to Veit. The bounty hunter tried to pick it up from his lap, but it just lay there.
A crude pick was carved on the rounded piece of rock.
"It's the mark of Grunyi, dwarf god of the mines. Good luck."
Veit nodded. Rudy patted his head as he passed. Erzbit swept her skirts over his legs. Oswald saluted him. Genevieve looked him in the eyes and saw his future in them.
"Tell me, Mistress Dieudonné,"
Veit said, each syllable an effort.
"What is it like being dead?"
She turned away and followed the others. Rudy was struck down next. By a simple mechanical device, Genevieve would have thought unworthy of the great enchanter. A mere matter of a hinged stone set in the floor, of counterweights and balances, of oiled joints and 3 iron-hard pieces of wood, the length and size of a heavy man. They sprang out of the wall. 2, one at chest height, one at knee height, swung out in front of Rudy, the last, between the others, from behind. They meshed like a 3-fingered fist, and the bandit was bent forwards and back between them. They could all hear his bones snapping. He hung there in the wooden grip, dripping blood and screaming oaths. Then the wooden arms drew back as suddenly as they had leaped out, and he fell in a jellied heap. Oswald jammed a sword into the wall to hold the arms back and went to him. It was worse than Genevieve had thought. He was still alive. Inside him, whenever he moved, his broken bones would be 100 knives.
"One by one," he said. "The devil is clever, my prince. You must leave old Rudy behind as you left Veit. Come back if you can."
There was blood on the prince's hands. Erzbit was kneeling by the bandit, feeling for his wounds, trying to find the broken places.
"Stay with him," Oswald told her. "Be alert."
So, only 3 came to the heart of Drachenfels.
Chapter 5. This was a throne room for a king of darkness. The rest of the fortress had been ill-lit and dilapidated, but this was spotless and illumined by jewelled chandeliers. The furniture was ostentatiously luxurious. Gold gleamed from every edge, and silver. Genevieve shuddered to be near so much of the stuff. There were fine paintings on the wall. Rudy would have wept to see so much plunder in one place. A clock chimed, counting unnatural hours as its single hand circled an unfamiliar dial. In a cage, a harpy preened herself, wiping the remains of her last meal from her feathered breasts. Genevieve's heart fluttered, as it had not done since she was truly alive. Oswald and Genevieve trod warily on the thick carpets as they circled the room.
"He's here," said the prince.
"Yes, I feel it too."
Manesh kept to the walls, stabbing at tapestries. One wall was a floor-to-ceiling window set with stained glass. From here, the great enchanter could gaze down from his mountain at Reichswald. He could see as far as Altdorf and trace the glittering thread of the River Reich through the forests. In the stained glass, there was a giant image of Khorne, the blood god, sitting upon his pile of human bones. With a chill, Genevieve realised that Drachenfels
didn't so much worship Corn as look down upon him as an amateur in the cause of evil. Chaos was so undisciplined. Drachenfels had never been without purpose. There were other gods, other shrines. Cain, Lord of Murder, was honoured in a modest ossuary, and Nurgle, Master of Pestilence and Decay, was celebrated by an odoriferous pile of mangled remains. From this stared the head of Seer Yehan, its eyes pecked out. Oswald started to see his tutor so abused, and a laugh resounded through the throne room. 600 years ago, Genevieve had heard that laugh, amid the crowds of Paravon, when the first family's assassin was borne aloft by demons and his insides fell upon the citizenry, a laugh somehow amplified by the metal mask from behind which it came. In that laughter, Genevieve heard the screams of the damned and the dying, the ripples of rivers of blood, the cracking of a million spines, the fall of a dozen cities, the pleas of murdered infants, the bleating of slaughtered animals. He loomed up, enormous, from his chair. He had been there all the time, but had worked his magics so none could see.
"I am Drachenfels," he said mildly, the deathly laugh still in his voice. "I bid you welcome to my house. Come in health, go safely, and leave behind some of the happiness you bring." Manesh flew at the great enchanter, a dwarfish miner's pick raised to strike. With a terrible languor, moving as might a man of molten bronze, Drachenfels stretched out and slapped him aside. Manesh struck a hanging and fell squealing in a heap. Blood was spurting from him. The harpy was excited and flapped her wings against the bars of her cage, smelling the blood. Drachenfels was holding the dwarf's arm in his hand. It had come off as easily as a cooked chicken's wing. The enchanter inclined his head to look at his souvenir, giggled, and cast it away from him. It writhed across the floor as if alive, trailing blood behind it, and was still. Genevieve looked at Oswald and saw doubt in the prince's face. He had his sword out, but it looked feeble set against the strength, the power of the great enchanter. Drachenfels opened a window in the air, and the stink of burning flesh filled the throne room. Genevieve peered through the window and saw a man twisting in eternal torment, demons rending his flesh, lashworms eating through his face, rats gnawing at his limbs. He called out her name and reached for her, reached through the window. Blood fell like rain onto the carpet. It was her father, her 6 centuries dead father.
"I have them all, you know," said Drachenfels. "All my old souls, all kept like that. It prevents me from getting lonely here in my humble palace."
He shut the window on the damned creature Genevieve had loved. She raised her sword against him. He looked from one to the other and laughed again. Spirits were gathering about him, evil spirits, servant spirits. They funneled around him like a tornado.
"So you have come to kill the monster. A prince of nothing, descendant of a family too cowardly to take an empire for themselves, and a poor dead thing without the sense to lie down.